Shabbat Shalom, Boker Tov, everyone. Let's talk a little bit about the Torah portion today, which is Bo. And I'll start it the way I generally do on Friday night, which is with the first few words. And the point of the name of the portion, of course, is Bo. Some of you have heard the expression Bo Mashiach, come Messiah. Again, you'll hear that from both Orthodox Jews and Hebraic-oriented former Christians and others who understand what's going on. And the word does tend to mean come, although sometimes people think it means go, simply because of the confusion I'm going to talk about right up front here. So chapter 10 is where we want to turn, book of Exodus, Shemot, story of the plagues. And I tell you what, let's talk plagues today because we are going to spend some time dealing with the plagues. Last week we had the first seven plagues. This week we're going to get the last, I'm going to say it this way, the last two plus one. Because I have become convinced for a number of years, and I'll spend a little bit more time talking in some detail today on that, that the plagues can be divided into sets of three. So you got three sets of three, and then you got one. And the one, of course, is the death of the firstborn. That gets a lot of ink in this week's Torah portion as well. Verse 1, chapter 10 says, And Yahuwah said unto Moses, and it's Ve'amar Yahuwah al Moshe, and he said, Yahuwah, unto Moses, go, no, come. The Bible I'm looking at in English actually translates it as go, but it really is come. The word is bo. And it says here, for I have already, essentially, I have hardened his heart. And this is where I'm going to stop and do a quick review of some of the things I spent a lot of time on last night, talking about the whole portion in detail. For one, right off the top, we can see this is a major change. Pharaoh has hardened his own heart, and he has strengthened his own heart. Those two different Hebrew words a number of times up until this point. One is chazak, to make it strong, and the other is basically to be stubborn. And he's done both. And this time, it is Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh who says, I have made kabod his heart. I have stubbornized his heart for him. He had his chance. He blew it. Now it's up to me. Here are a number of big changes going on. And, of course, as we expect, as the plagues roll to a close, that's a big change. We've talked about previous changes and how, originally the plagues were visited on everybody, and then later on there was a distinction made. We're going to see another big distinction tonight, and that is, although the people of Israel are still going to be separated, they have to do something this time. They don't just merely have to be in the land of Goshen to be separated. They have to do, well, two things, really. They have to go get a lamb. They have to go through the process, put the blood on the lintels, on the doorposts of their houses. So the step one basically is to mark their house, each of their houses, with the blood of the lamb. And secondly, they got to stay in the house. They got to stay put, not go outside. If they go outside, it would be obvious that there might be a problem. The death messenger is going to pass over the houses that are marked. And here's the other thing. Of course, that is a separation. This is a separation of the people of Israel. And by the way, we're, I think, going to believe that it's a mixed multitude. We're going to find that discussion beginning here as well. But it would also seem that there have been people who have been listening to Moshe and who have learned, perhaps the hard way, that like E.F. Hutton, when he speaks, they had better listen. And I don't have any doubt that there were a lot of people in Mitzrayim who were not previously considered as Israelites, but who heard the story and said, you know what, I think I'm going to get me a lamb too, mark my doorpost. And later, many of those people obviously joined in the mixed multitude. So key point here, the big changes that are taking place, and this is the first time where we really see the people of Israel and those who would like to be grafted in have to get up and take action. Before they may have brought their animals indoor, but now they have to literally mark their house so that the bad things that are promised don't happen to them. There are some other elements. We're going to talk about that in a second as we spend some more time talking about the plagues in detail. But I want to mention a couple other of the primary elements of this particular portion of Bo. Goes through chapter 13, about halfway. And that is something that we're also going to see a number of times in here. Teach your children. Teach your children. It's a responsibility. It's a commandment. And furthermore, it's not just teach them by rote, but I think it is important, and certainly the Midrashim, the various things that you can read about this portion and the discussions that have happened over the centuries make it real clear. And I do think this is a tradition that not only is based in Scripture. I was asked this question earlier. Are there some examples of traditions that are scriptural? Yeah, here's a good one in this portion. Teach your children, and in particular, the Scripture implies the questions. And so I'm going to suggest that one of the traditions is you better teach your children to ask questions too. In other words, it is a tradition that flows, and I'm thinking about things that you'll see in the Haggadah, the Passover Seder traditions and so forth. Not all of them are explicitly from Scripture. Some are. But this concept, this understanding that we better learn to teach our children, especially teach them to ask questions, also is directly implied in here anyway. So there's another one of the lessons from this week. Finally, we're also going to be exposed to the feasts. This is going to be a beginning of months for you. This is literally when the record timekeeping starts in the Hebraic and in the Bible understanding of things. Starts in this month in the spring. This will be a beginning of months to you. It is the month of the Passover. And it starts on that full moon, or that new moon, and we're going to count those days, and on the 10th day, and then the other things that follow. That's when the lamb is taken, and so forth. So there's this idea of the feasts. They're introduced, and then, of course, we're told this, and I cannot help but repeat this when we see it, and it's so important. Keep these forever. I've been told, oh, you keep the Jewish feasts. No! For crying out loud, what kind of idiocy is that? And I have no problem with the fact that the Jewish people, may they be blessed for their obedience, and other people who wouldn't necessarily call themselves Jewish, although that name probably gets twisted around a lot this year, this season, this time in history. There were 12 tribes. Judah was one of them. There were others too. There were other tribes that were historically part of the southern kingdom that were called Judah. And, I got no problem with any number of the various ways that people have understood the term over the years. But let's be clear. These are not Jewish feasts, although it's good that they keep them. These are, and he tells us over and over and over again, these are my feasts. These are the appointed times of Yah. And this portion is one of those many places where he says, keep them in your houses throughout your generations forever. A friend of mine once years ago, when we were having this discussion, well, when did that stop? Yeah, when did God decide to start telling us the truth? Answer, he's been telling us the truth all along. It's men that have lied to us, saying these are Jewish feasts and that they're done away with and we don't have to keep them anymore. And of course, we know the history. During the evil Middle Ages, when the so-called church fathers decided literally to hell with the God of the Bible, we got better gods now that we're fish hats. We're going to mix and do all kinds of things he forbade. And what did they do? They forbade keeping his feasts. You're Judaizing. It was a capital crime. They killed people for doing that kind of stuff. Absolutely reprehensible. No wonder we got a lot of problems. So, I'm going to emphasize all of those things. When we see, if we read through Scripture where it says, these are my feasts, keep them forever throughout your generations, I'm going to suggest, this is a really tough pill to swallow for some folks, that he actually means what he says. And he wrote it down in genuine print for a reason. So, with that bit of review, I'll say it again too. If there are questions, then you can put them up on the screen. Maybe I'll even be able to read them, and I'll definitely try to answer them. We'll try to buffer them and keep them away. Literally, I mean, screens are popping up and down. Pal Talk is probably rebooting on me twice a minute. Twice a minute, at this point. So, ask the questions, we'll wait for the lag, we'll see if we can get them, and I'll try to address them. And as always, of course, mark@marknywot.com is the email address. I know a lot of times I'll get questions after the fact, because probably many more people listen on the podcasts than hear us live on Shabbat or on Erev Shabbat on Friday evening. And we're happy for the feedback and the questions. I'll try to get to them one way or the other anyway. Like I said, though, on to the plagues. Let's talk about a few of those because I think that's real important. And if we believe, and I'm certainly one who makes no secret of the fact that I believe eventually, may we live, may we be blessed, may we stand, may we be counted worthy to escape the things that are coming. All of those prophetic admonitions still apply. May we see this time of the greater exodus, the regathering, when we are to be regathered from all the nations that we have been scattered to and within and among. So as we start talking about the plagues, I'm going to do a couple of things. One, I'm going to turn just briefly to the Haftorah portion that goes with this week's Torah portion. And note that, it starts in Jeremiah chapter 46, about halfway, verse 13. And it begins with the word of Yahuwah speaking to Jeremiah the prophet, talking about a guy that we've probably heard the name, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon. He was going to come and strike the land. And the land of Egypt and so forth. Well, Nebuchadnezzar turns out to be a major conqueror. He's going to strike a lot of folks. Egypt, it says in verse 20, Mitzrayim is a pretty heifer, a very pretty heifer. Interesting choice of phrase, right? When destruction comes, it comes from the north. And then we get around to what I think are the key verses that I'm going to point to, at least right now, and say, these seem to be not just a warning of something that obviously did happen. You know, the single prophetic fulfillment, you know, by name with Nebuchadnezzar that we can point to and say, yep, that happened. But how about other ones too? I am a firm believer that cycles repeat, that men make the same mistakes. And as Solomon said, what goes around comes around. what has been is what shall be done. What has been done is what shall be done. And there's nothing new under the sun. He's talking about cycles. The equation to the laws of motion and electromagnetics and everything else that the Creator put in place, including human nature. They go according to cycles. Well, verse 25 is where we kind of hit the rubber meets the road here. It says, Yahuwah Zevuot, Elohim of Israel says, behold, I will bring punishment on Ammon of No and Pharaoh in Egypt with their gods and their kings, Pharaoh and those who trust in him. Well, that's funny, because Jeremiah happened after the original Exodus. We've already seen one set of plagues and judgments on the gods of Mitzrayim, of Egypt. We're talking about another one, and I'm going to suggest to you that's probably happened more than once or twice, and that certainly that would be an element of what I suspect we're going to see happen again. And it's interesting, this turn of phrase here, too, on Pharaoh and those who trust in him. Dare I suggest that that applies to American Pharaoh today and those who trust in him too? You know, the fact, and I've mentioned this a number of times, that the first Triple Crown winner in years, decades even, happened last year. And how funny is it that the Creator of the universe does have a sense of humor that the name of the horse was American Pharaoh? Verse 27 and 28 are the ones that I'm leading up to here. And I've got this little heading in the study Bible. I like it. It says, Elohim will preserve Israel. And it goes like this. These are the words in red, again, or at least they should be if this Bible put them in red, because they are in quotation marks. But do not fear, O my servant Yaakov, and do not be dismayed, O Israel. Here it is again, one of those places when there is a dual mode of address. Wait a minute, aren't Jacob and Israel the same person? Didn't Jacob get renamed? He's one of the few that Scripture kind of continues to use this dual method of address. And while I don't think this is exactly the whole of it, at least as kind of a simple approximation, it makes sense to think, it looks like Yaakov is the means of address when we're talking about the more physically inclined, the more directly non-spiritual aspects of whatever is being proposed here. And they use the term Israel to describe something a little bit more, well, spiritual, broader, deeper in extent. But in this case, both of them are clearly referring to people that, at least in the physical sense, have departed this mortal coil. So he is talking to everybody, in other words, be they more spiritually inclined or more physically inclined, that would have descended from Jacob. in either sense, spiritual sense, physical sense, probably broader still. So, do not fear, O my servant Yaakov. Do not be dismayed, O Israel. For behold, I will save you from afar, and your offspring from the land of their captivity. Yaakov shall return, have rest, and be at ease. No one shall make him afraid. Do not fear, O Yaakov, my servant, says Yahuwah, for I am with you. For I will make a complete end of all the nations to which I have driven you, but I will not make a complete end of you. Now here I pause before I get to the real clincher, the last line in this chapter. Now, note that it's Yaakov that's being addressed directly, the more physical aspect of these descendants, and of course, fear not, most common command in Scripture. Makes sense that he would need to tell that to the more carnally inclined, if you want to use that term. I tend to try to avoid it, but it fits here. Do not fear, O Yaakov, my servant, says Yahuwah, for I'm with you. I will make a complete end of all the nations to which I have driven you. Now, at least to me, yes, that could have applied before, but more even than the things that have already preceded it in this prophetic set of verses, that one seems to kind of hold out a special promise for what I would call the greater exodus, the greater regathering that we're told about still to come. I'll make a complete end of the nations to which I have driven you, but I will not make a complete end of you. Here comes the but, the rest of it. For I will rightly correct you, chasten you. Remember, those he loves, he chastens. We're told that a number of places. For I will not leave you wholly unpunished. You're not going to die outright. Fear not. I'll make a complete end of those nations to which you have been driven. Gee, does that seem to apply today? But I will rightly correct you, and I will not leave you wholly unpunished. Now, I read that up front. We may come back to it again. Certainly the concept is something we're going to come back to, because it fits, and because that is kind of at the essence of the plagues. I'm going to go through some of the connections, the groupings of these plagues, and in particular for the reason of saying, what can we learn about those plagues that might apply to what plagues are coming? And I'm going to suggest that verse is key. You're not going to die, at least not all of you, but you will not be left wholly unpunished. Those that he loves, he chastens. And let's think about at least one of the real simple, obvious things from these three sets of three, the nine plagues that have already been described now at this point in the story. And it starts out with the first three that are visited on everybody. Well, there you go, right? Whatever the characteristics of those first three plagues are, one of them that they share in common is, I will not leave you wholly unpunished. The people of Goshen, the land of Goshen, the sons of Israel too, suffered from those first few plagues. Dare I suggest that if we're looking at the plagues that we expect to have happen, whether they've started already is an interesting question, and it's probably one that bears more discussion. But any way you slice it, they are going to be visited on a whole lot of people, including those who are his. And I'm sitting here thinking about watching my screen flash about every 30 seconds and seeing the destruction of the World Wide Web and the fact that we have appreciated being able to gather together here. This is a wonderful resource. Yes, it can be used for good or for evil. It can be used for control and for manipulation, and it can be used to get together and share the word of Yah and let iron sharpen iron. And when the web is being messed with by evil people for evil means, or whether the Creator is allowing it to happen, or whether, kind of like the frogs, he does it, and then Pharaoh's guys say, we can make more frogs too. We'll fill the internet with frogs, right? Somebody wrote online about the frogs this morning, and I'm thinking, yeah, the frogs are probably the metaphor for the current time. We got frogs all over the place, folks. Internet frogs, croaking and creaking and causing problems. I'm seeing them flash on the screen even as I'm speaking. Is this a rehearsal for taking down the net completely? Could be. And, well, again, certainly it's the kind of thing that this morning alone, we've seen just example after example, not limited to one system. Paltalk's been having problems. The other uplinks have been having problems. I'm seeing complaints from all over the place. Our internet service provider has been an absolute mess. And the satellite's usually a mess, though. It's worse than most others. So, you know, I'm interested in getting some feedback over the next few days. People that are listening to this later, are you seeing more problems than usual? Well, you know, one of the keys, if you're going to do this and you're going to have dress rehearsals and get people conditioned, is the answer to that question should be no. Right? Big Brother should be saying, oh, if the answer is that there are places that aren't seeing it, well, we need to redouble our efforts, make sure that everybody gets a little hint of what's coming. Okay, so it's hard to tell. It's nothing that I can see that I can fix it here. You know, it's probably coming through NSA's headquarters. There in Utah, he said, with more than a little bit of disgust. I'm not sure. So we got Echo 2. Yes, as if we don't have enough frogs. The point was, the early plagues did apply to everybody, and later he makes a distinction. Now, what I want to do next is talk about a couple other things that are pretty clear that we've mentioned over the last 2 weeks or so, at least at this point, and that is that these plagues also maybe it's not obvious to some of the folks that are coming out of the Sunday churches, but it's obvious to people that have been in the Torah portions for a little while, at least been through this once or twice. That is that these plagues are all explicit condemnations of particular gods of Egypt. And the way I like to explain it, and you've probably all heard me say this at least once or twice, it's like the real God is holding up these little fake imitation so-called Elohim one at a time and shaking them a little bit, turning them upside down and whacking them around the head and shoulders and saying, gods? You call these things gods? You think this is a god? I'll show you the real one and only Ani Yahuwah. So we had it starting with the Nile River, one of the most important gods to the land of Mitzrayim, right? It was the thing that brought life, flooded the land and helped them grow their crops. And so he starts there, turns it into blood. Also symbolic of life, interestingly enough, but in this case, it's got to do with what they were doing to it. They were drowning babies in it. They were doing all kinds of things. Another interesting connection that we've addressed. So start with the fact that at least we can see that these plagues were explicit condemnations of specific gods and indeed the whole concept of paganism. Now next, I've got at least literally dozens of various whole articles, midrashim, commentaries that will point out the various groupings. And I'm looking at a specific one. This one came from the web. You could find it probably pretty easily from Rabbi Ari Kahn. And it's called Examining the Plan Behind the Plagues. And he quotes a couple of the people, in particular, probably the most famous, let me think here a second. I'm looking for the name of the guy. It's in here. I'll get to it in a second. Who have been dividing these plagues up into groups literally for centuries. Rabbi Yehuda, in a tradition popularized by the Haggadah, he says, divides the 10 plagues into three groups of three plus one. So I think it's a really good division. Obviously, it makes a lot of sense. And I just want to make sure everybody knows that, you know, I didn't think of it, and the people that taught me didn't think of it, and the people that taught them didn't think of it. It's been around for a long time. But it is clear once you begin to see it. So you got three groups of three. And let's mention them briefly this way. You got the first one, you have blood, or the Nile, then frogs, and then lice. We know there's a distinction that's made after that first set of three. We'll talk about the distinctions too. Then you got wild beasts and pestilence and boils, followed by the last three, hail, and then this week's introductory plague, locusts, and then of course the plague of darkness, which is pretty clearly a condemnation of the great god of the sun, Ra, in Egypt. And then the death of the firstborn kind of stands by itself, and we did talk about that quite a bit last night. Again, this idea of children and the firstborn, the Bakor, and how that's important, and how it literally is the thing that both represents the follow-on, how it is that generation after generation this interface from one generation to the next happens, at least what's supposed to happen, and what, of course, has eventually broken down, hence the scattering. It needs to be reestablished. It's part of the process, and of course, it's real, real key to the symbolism of how all of these things fit together. But here now is where the rubber meets the road. So let's put it this way. I like this turn of phrase. Each plague, says this summary, ought to be seen as one specific tactic within a larger strategy. We're talking about the ultimate chess master in the universe, the man of war, as we're going to be revealed in the next couple portions. The master of war, really, is a better way to put it. The master capitalized. So here you go. Here's the standard breakdown of these groupings. Note that there are similarities between the first, second, and third plague of each of these three groups. And that takes us back to the beginning of this one, where we see the word bow, which doesn't really, as my King James-ish one looks like it says here, go on into Pharaoh. It really means come. So what it really says is come to Pharaoh. And if we put it that way in English, it not only reveals what is being hidden by the bad translation, but it makes the pattern more clear. That's part of the reason why, you know, when I hear people literally worshiping the King James and saying, you know, that's what Jesus spoke was the King James, it's hard not to laugh. Because there's a whole lot that's been obscured and left out and is just plain wrong. And we miss if we're not willing to go back and study to show ourselves approved. Hey, I heard that advice somewhere. It's probably good advice. So let's go back to this idea of the first, second, and third plagues within each group. And that will be easily seen if we look at that strange phrase, come to Pharaoh. Because that's really what it says, bo Pharaoh. It's not unique to the eighth plague. It turns out that each of the number two plagues in the three sets, all right, you with me? Each another of the second plagues in the two sets says bow. So the second plague, that would be the plague of frogs as well as pestilence and so forth. And conversely, the first plague in each of these three sets, we saw it with the Nile River and blood, and then the beasts, and then the hail, uses a different word. The word in the Hebrew is lech, as opposed to bow, and that literally means go to Pharaoh. So why is it that sometimes it says go to Pharaoh, sometimes it says come to Pharaoh? What's the difference? Well, if we will read carefully, say the sages, it's clear that whenever the word come is used, come to Pharaoh, the destination is the palace, Pharaoh's palace. Whereas if it's go to Pharaoh, well, Pharaoh went to the Nile River a lot of times. Remember, we got lots of folks going to the Nile to bathe and to do whatever. Probably had an entourage with him, right? When the word go is used, bow, as it is in this week's portion to begin the set, the destination is the Nile. Okay, now a whole lot of stuff begins to fall into place. What's the difference between those two places? Well, one, the Nile is pretty public. Two, the Nile is obviously this place where this god is. There's an element of that. And compare that, contrast it with this concept of the palace. The palace is a private place. The palace is like the White House. And I think the pun ought to be intended. It's a private place. There's private elements, at least, within the palace where the peons aren't normally allowed to go. So, for Egyptians in general, and Pharaoh in particular, the Nile represented their god and a form of power. It was the life force of Egypt. And again, it is a public place. So it's interesting, therefore, that the first plague of each set of three was announced at the Nile. Kind of, if you will, it was like a public announcement. And when Pharaoh's out in public, he's in his public persona. As opposed to when he's in private, he's in a private mode. And furthermore, the sages will point out, there's a lot of other things that go on here too. We probably don't even have time to go into all of the little nuances that we could talk about, because this is a fascinating study. But one, the Nile was also a place, of course, because of the connection with the river and the gods and so forth. It was a pagan place, a place of pagan ritual observance. And it would seem, given the way the phrasing is used to Moshe and to Aaron, in other words, they basically are told in advance, and then when they go there, Elohim's presence is hidden, is the way the sages talk about this. Elohim's presence is hidden, and some suggest it's because it's a public place, literally, where there's a pagan presence. But in private, now Elohim will reveal himself through Moshe and Aaron, and Pharaoh gets it, if you will, right directly, from the fire hose. So we go back to the second plague. It's got that phrase, Bo Pharaoh. And some of them have said, well, maybe another way to render it is come with me to Pharaoh. Not just come, bow to Pharaoh, but come with me to Pharaoh and I will be with you. And remember again, the destination is the palace. And at these meetings, Elohim is going to be there directly. And finally, when we get to the third plague, we see something that's kind of dramatic by its absence. Each first plague and second plague, we get a public announcement, a private announcement. And then the third plague, bam, gotcha. You didn't listen to the first two, and now here you go. In other words, something happens without a warning. And by the way, Pharaoh doesn't get a warning either. So the pattern has to do with a number of things. And now let's go back and talk about the three sets of three. And note the following. First plague of each set, blood, wild beasts, and hail, the first of the three, the announced publicly at the river version of the plague, are public things, and they represent, therefore, kind of a public comeuppance. And I saw it phrased this way, as an invasion of Egyptian territory. And in the first of the first three sets, it was the Nile itself, the most public and the most important part of all of Mitzrayim that was hit directly. The Egyptian life force bleeding. And the significance of that, to those that, you know, doesn't come out of the Sunday church anyway, could not have been lost on the ancient Egyptians. This was their most important force of life, the river itself, and it's literally turned into blood. So we got the public comeuppance with a public warning. Second plague, a private warning. And by the way, there's more to it than that as well. The second plague does seem to have more of a widespread private effect. So it's a private warning to Pharaoh as a person, and it's also a personal chastisement against the people. Think about the frogs. These frogs are nasty. They appear everywhere and they get in everything. They're in your kneading bowls. They're in your bed. Eck, right? Frogs, frogs, frogs. What a mess. That's about as personal a front as you can get. Well, until you get to the next set of three and the second plague and so forth. I like this turn of phrase. Rabbi Rav Shimson ben Raphael Hirsch explains that the first plague in each of these three triplets was designed to make the people of Mitzrayim feel like strangers in their own land. Strangers in their own land. Remember, Abraham was a stranger in another land, a stranger in a strange land. And basically, it's turning their world upside down a bit. The second of the three sets in each, well, the second plague in each of the triplets was designed, he said, to counter the feeling of superiority that lies at the core of the kind of person that is used to having slaves around. In other words, hey, I'm better than you. You're a slave. I'm not a slave. These plagues were mostly involved with the possessions of the people of Egypt. The frogs infested their homes, spoiled their bread. The pestilence killed their herds. The locusts wiped out their crops. And that makes a lot of sense. Okay, in the third set of, in each of the third plagues in the triplet, though, they're different. Not only was there no warning, but it does seem clearly like there were lessons that should have been learned in the first two plagues that weren't. So you have the idea that these plagues were intended to teach moral lessons, social values, philosophical tenets, and the third plague, in other words, is punishment. You didn't listen to the first plague, public one. You didn't get the private message. Okay, bang, here we go. Punishment. to heed the lessons of the two preceding plagues. So each of the third plagues contains literally an element of physical discomfort or torture. Not that there wasn't plenty of that already, I guess. So part of the reason, therefore, that's why no warning was forthcoming for the third plague in each group of three. Now there's another element of this. Because we've talked about Bo, come to Pharaoh, and Lech, go to Pharaoh. And the fact that it's at different places, kind of a public and a private persona. And if you think about it, now you got to ask the obvious question. This doesn't get pointed out in Scripture, but it's something that I remember thinking when I was a kid. And, you know, it still kind of applies. It's one of those things probably kids think about more than adults do nowadays. This guy Moshe, he's kind of a pain in the you-know-what, right? He shows up, bad stuff happens. Do you think, maybe there comes a time about plague, I don't know, 4, 5, 6, somewhere in there, where Pharaoh says, you know, that guy shows up at the door, don't let him in. Why do they keep letting Moshe in? And, you know, we saw it in this last plague, in the 8th plague, that his advisors say, you know, Egypt is destroyed, for crying out loud. You gotta figure, there comes a point at which Moshe is persona non grata at the palace. But he does, he goes in. Now, doesn't it make sense? A lot of the sages have said, surely Pharaoh and the palace were pretty well protected. He probably had guards. And the fact that Moshe was still able to walk in unmolested must have been a slight irritation to Pharaoh. Matter of fact, might even have been intimidating. And, you know, now that you think about it, you go back, you read people like Elijah. He goes in to see King Ahab. Okay, this is a guy they'd like to kill. He shows up in the king's chamber. There is something going on when these prophets, in other words, can walk into the most important and most powerful man in the land and just deliver a message, thus says Yah, to their face. Moshe does not seek permission. He enters unannounced. And you got to figure, this is essentially some of the Midrash. Pharaoh's bodyguards probably quivered. Maybe the guard dogs whimpered a bit. Ooh, he's back! And all of that just added to the private humiliation of Pharaoh as well. He is getting humiliated in public when he goes out to the Nile. And here it is, in his own house, this guy comes and tells him something personal that is a further humiliation. So in this case, not only does Moshe manage to get in, regardless of whether or not he's been told not to, but Pharaoh is being approached as a private person, as an individual. And that kind of, again, resonates with the idea of these three plagues and the fact that the middle of the three in each set is an individual, specific chastening. So we got this dual plan that emerges here. Three sets of three. And Pharaoh is challenged publicly. The Nile is turned to blood. And then he is approached privately, where he could presumably let his guard down, maybe even ask some questions. We see some discussions that take place. When his subjects aren't watching, maybe he'll have a different attitude. At least he did the first few times. In the second of the plagues in the final set with Bo, right? We see this negotiation attempt. And we also see that he is not going to be allowed to really negotiate. His heart has been made stubborn by the Creator himself. He's following through with this whether he wants to or not at this point. So I hope that at least helps to make some of the point. I'm going to have to reconnect to Pal Talk again. It has collapsed as it has been inclined to do. And since we're talking about the plagues and the three sets of three and all that kind of jazz, maybe this is a good time to readdress that question. There are so many things that happen in the United States that would literally impact everybody. I'm thinking of a power grid failure. Now, if I was architecting a three set of three plagues, I'd put the power grid failure somewhere about plague number two in the third set. In other words, the 8th plague. That's going to affect everybody and hurt them big time and bad and universally. Before that, how about, around plague number two, or maybe plague number four, first or second set, we start plaguing the internet. All right, now here's the logical thought process. I'm just going to encourage people to kind of go through this and say, okay, if you have a candidate for a modern plague, let's say, taking down of the internet. The plague of frogging the internet. Makes sense to me that might be number two plague. And why do I say number two as opposed to number four in the second set? Well, answer, because at some point the Creator begins to make a distinction, right? And also it fits that Pharaoh's people make frogs too. So think of it this way, right? The Creator of the universe says, I can put out solar flares and I can do various things that will affect stuff that people rely on. And Pharaoh's pigs, Pharaoh's magicians, pardon me, they say, well, we can too, right? We can simulate solar flares. We can cyber attack the grid. We can do all kinds of things and blame it on God. And somebody asked the question last week. It's a great question, right? How can we tell Pharaoh's frogs from the frogs of God? And the answer is maybe in a lot of cases you can't. Back to the second plague, and if the internet is one of the early plagues, I'll say it that way, if, and it's clearly one that that Pharaoh's magicians could do, and so can the Creator. Well, if that's true, it would also have this effect of affecting everybody, so it does look like the number two in the set is a good place for it to be there. And finally, again, it... at the point where the entire web goes down, but the people of Yah have another way to communicate or whatever it is that's necessary, now there's a distinction that's made. So several of the keys here in terms of putting the plagues in the buckets, if you will, involve looking at who's affected, how widespread is it? Is it a public or a private kind of a demonstration of the power of the Creator? And does it affect just the people who are in the system, those who have not come out of her, or does it affect everybody? And the ones that affect everybody universally, more likely to be seen later than the ones, at least I will suggest, that that result in a separation from those who are his and attempt to come out of her. So that's a good transition point, because I've got a list. I'm gonna replay the Come Out of Her, My People show from Thursday too. I hope folks will enjoy at least part of that. And without stealing all that thunder, I'm gonna indicate that some of the things that I mentioned there are other ways to divide the modern plagues as well. Some of them we've already talked about. So let me just list a few of them, see how they fit. Normally when people see and hear the word plagues, they think of things like Ebola and anthrax and various, bioengineered stuff. Hey, there is a perfect example of something that the Creator, has done and said, don't eat pig, don't eat shellfish, don't eat these things that I tell you are not food. Science can go look at them and say, maybe it's because they're the bottom feeders. These are the things that clean up the poisons, the death, the heavy metals. You want to find out where the mercury and the heavy metals in the ocean go? Answer, shellfish. Now, if you put enough poison in the oceans, as has been done from Fukushima now, you can poison everything all up and down the food chain. But at least to start with, I remember years and years ago, there would be, announcements of a mercury release or toxic metals that have spilled out of some industrial pollutant into the Gulf of Mexico or whatever, and they'll say, don't eat the shellfish. Well, don't eat the shellfish anyway, because that's what shellfish do. They're designed by the Creator to clean stuff up. They're the bottom end of that chain. It makes sense, in other words, that that would be one of those places where the people begin to make their own separation. Those who are his would begin to understand, okay, I don't eat the pig. If you are a Torah observant believer in the Creator, I'd be willing to bet that in most cases, there are other factors clearly, but that means your immune system is going to be stronger than those people who are eating crap that they're told is food that's not. It's just that simple. And arguably, similar things could apply to genetically modified frankenfoods and so forth that aren't explicitly prohibited by the Bible, but, I read the admonition against blood and against mixing things, the clean and the unclean, and torquing things out of place and trying to play God. You can be like God, you will not die. All of that seems to say to me, you know what? Eat what you want if you choose to. But don't say you weren't warned, and for crying out loud, don't feed me genetically modified crap. I'm gonna avoid it like the plague that it is. So back to these other plagues, all right? We got a number of potential kinds of plagues, and we could divide them this way as well. Are these plagues primarily man-made, or are they clearly what the insurance providers would call acts of God? And we've generally thought, for example, that earthquakes, floods, hurricanes, and tornadoes, those are acts of God. Although man, his magicians, now he's got HARP, and now he's got chemtrails, the term geoengineering seems to be preferred, and maybe other kinds of technologies we're not sure of. The Russians and the Americans have both talked about tidal wave bombs. That's a big fear, allegedly, from the Pentagon, that the Russians have a tidal wave bomb, and then they could literally destroy the entire seacoast, up and down, and for miles inward, by lighting off some nukes underwater. Well, you know that's going to send a tidal wave ashore. Does that look like an act of God? Well, it's probably the kind of thing that most people would be able to say, hey, those are Pharaoh's magicians pulling that stunt. We got other ones that fall into that camp too, like CERN and HARP. Most of you have heard of HARP, the High Altitude Auroral Research Project. Basically, it's got to do with ionospheric heating. At least that's the claim. And of course, if you believe that HARP exists, you must be a conspiracy theorist. Well, folks, as a ham radio operator, I can tell you I've been a ham since before I could drive a car. Let's just say a number of decades at this point. I remember as a kid listening to what we called the Russian woodpecker on the ham bands. It was called an over-the-horizon radar in those days. That's what we were told it was. Later we were told it was ionospheric heating. Later we were told it was HARP. Later we were told, no, doesn't exist at all. You made it up. Well, the answer is, I don't know, but I've been listening to it, knowing what it is for decades. And of course, they changed the frequencies over time. So HARP is real. The question is, what does it do? It clearly can perform ionospheric heating and other things, including, some say, steering major storm systems, including hurricanes. You want to steer a hurricane so that it hits New Orleans directly or east side or west side rather than missing a few miles? Well, HARP is your tool. Just maybe. Are we going to be told the truth? Well, you know the answer to that one. Is it a conspiracy theory to think it might have happened? No. Bottom line is I can't prove it one way or the other. But I'm going to throw HARP on the list, at least, of potential plagues, along with CERN. Now, CERN is the super colliding, superconducting magnet array buried deep underground on the Swiss border. Turns out it's buried at an old pagan site, and if you look, the more you look at CERN, I've got some friends, Daniel Holdings has done a nice show on it here just within the last couple of weeks. He and many, many others that I've known have talked about it. As a person with an interest in physics, this has fascinated me for a long time. Once upon a time, I would have said, hey, CERN is a great thing. You know, it's the kind of research I'd love to see happen. And yet, the more I find out about CERN, the more I realize it had nothing to do with the physics that I was interested in. It seems to honestly have a lot to do with Shiva, you know, pagan gods. Why is it that there's so much pagan god and goddess symbol associated with these so-called science projects? And they're spending a whole hell of a lot more money on CERN than they were ever willing to spend on something I thought was a lot more important, which was, you know, clean nuclear fusion power for everybody. Don't give me this crap about man-made, non-existent global warming and how we're going to instead, you know, destroy your ability to heat your house, provide electricity, and drive your car when, for a lot less money, people could have been developing clean fusion power. But obviously, there's another agenda here that we're not being told about. It would seem that that other agenda actually might include some really, really nasty pagan stuff. In the case of CERN. Now that's a whole other show and discussion. But I'm going to put it in the list along with some other things that people call conspiracy theorists that just might also represent plagues. I mentioned one, geoengineering. Okay, the idea of, well, we're going to spray the atmosphere full of all of these salts, barium and aluminum and so forth. Now that can serve a number of purposes, right? Can reflect sunlight from the upper ionosphere and, well, the higher levels, basically up in the levels 40,000 feet and so on, wherever those things get dispersed as they later settle back to Earth and pollute the land. The term has been called terraforming, literally changing the very characteristics of the Earth and its climate. I think of two more big three more big examples that should be in the news today that by and large aren't. First one, let's drill a well in the Gulf of Mexico all the way deeper than has ever been drilled before and see if we can't tap into some kind of black pussy ooze that will come out spew like a volcano and pollute the whole stinking Gulf of Mexico and eventually, if we help it a bit, shut down the Gulf Stream current. How's that? You might know it as the BP oil spill, one of the worst economic and ecological disasters in human history. And they followed it up with Corexit, which had one purpose, and that was to hide the amount of oil that was being spewed into the Gulf and disperse it, and literally in the process, shut off the Gulf Stream. Talk about terraforming and man-made changes to climate. Well, there's a real one. Unlike anthropogenic carbon dioxide, you're breathing out too much, global warming. And then, of course, there's Fukushima. Fukushima, arguably the biggest man-made disaster in all of human history, has spewed untold amounts of radiation. Everything from plutonium and other heavy metal radioactive isotopes on down. Cesium, the big one. At least the most proliferous one. Is Fukushima the reason why the Pacific Ocean is almost dead? Well, you're not going to hear a lot of scientific study or discussion of the matter. What instead you're going to hear is, yeah, deafening silence. The EPA actually took out most of the radiation monitors years ago, refused to tell people about it. They're still denying the huge numbers of sailors that were on board, was it the Ronald Reagan aircraft carrier that was offshore Fukushima? And they literally had gonads that swelled up to the size of tennis balls, hair falling out in clumps. You've got huge numbers of people all over that area coming down with any, you know, incredible radiation diseases, all of which has by and large been denied until it couldn't be denied anymore. Tens of thousands of people have died, and untold numbers of sea creatures and so forth. Incredible disaster. And now, of course, the latest one's in California. Underground, 6,000 feet or so deep, there's a methane leak, probably the biggest ever. The governor of California, Moonbeam Brown, finally declared a state of emergency. People have been sickened. It turns out that there may be radiation in the methane as well, and multiple millions of people live in the immediate area. Could be affected. And yet, for the most part, the press is strangely silent. No, you need to be more concerned about the non-existent threat of man-made global warming. And we're going to lie to you about the economy. You're peddling fiction if you tell people what the truth is with the economy. And instead, we're going to disarm you. So, you know, all the better to kill you, my dear. Lots of man-made plagues as a possibility. Contrast that with some other kind of plagues that aren't medical in nature that could be creator-made, acts of God, if you will. We've talked about earthquakes. We know that that's one of the things prophesied in Matthew 24, and probably elsewhere too, but that's the most famous one. Earthquakes in diverse places. If you look at a plot of earthquakes for the last several centuries and compare major earthquakes, you know, fives and especially sixes and above, in the last few years, you'll see a dramatic, undeniable increase in terms of major earthquakes. Same thing goes for volcanism, volcanoes. Got more volcanoes active right now than in, well, certainly in any of our lifetimes and probably in 300 or 400 years. San Fernando Valley, I think. Porter Ranch, if I'm remembering correctly, is the name of the town where people were most sick and literally it was bubbling up. If you go online, you can literally find in the infrared, there are infrared photos because the gas is invisible. All the better to hide it, right? But the invisible gas shows up on an infrared photo and looks like a volcano, literally. It looks like a volcano over the valley. Incredible. 67 million tons, I remember the numbers, is just lots of zeros. Maybe it's 67 million gallons. I don't know. It's an incredible amount of methane. I could pull up the chart. You could take a look and see online. ENE News is a good place for a lot of that kind of stuff. There are many others, and I may have one in my stack here. It's just out of order. When I get to it, I'll give you the numbers. So here you go. There are several ways to divide plagues, in other words, that might be man-made, might be God-made, and might be hard to tell because for the most part, people are being lied to about the level of technology that Pharaoh's magicians have. Okay, can we start volcanoes? Possibly. Certainly earthquakes can be simulated. North Korea simulated one, a 5.1 just a little while ago. The micro ice age or the mini ice age that might be coming is another one. People are being told man-made global warming is a problem, and some of us, including a lot of solar scientists, say, nope, the opposite's true. We're going to see a major period of global cooling as a result of changes in the sun. And I'm not willing to believe yet that man is responsible for that one. There are some other things that are clearly, explicitly man-made. And I've already addressed a few of those. What I'm doing is transitioning now through a set of these possible plagues, Fukushima among them. How about bioweapons? Now, here we're talking about plagues that could certainly look a lot more like the kind of things, too, that God could create. If people's immune systems are destroyed because they're not eating what he says is food, then we have a possibility of plagues that come. The bubonic plague, the black plague, any number of similar things that have affected humans over history, trichinosis, a lot of things that clearly come through pigs. As a matter of fact, all the major pandemics, the Spanish flu in the World War I era, absolutely, positively came through pigs. That's why they're called swine flus as a group. Because, and scientists even pointed this out, let's just say a few years ago before it got popular to lie about it. You'll find a few honest ones that still will. Every major pandemic in history always came through pigs. How ironic is that? How prescient is the Creator's word on that score? Now we got a different issue because, of course, a lot of these plagues are bioengineered. And if you're a bio-plague engineer, well, one of the things you need to know is, well, yeah, you start with pigs. Start with the pig genes because that's the easiest way to make a virus that affects an animal that you like the characteristics of. Maybe it's had a high mortality rate, or maybe it's particularly infectious, or maybe it causes something you just really want to see happen, like bleeding from the eyes, or who knows what it is that the desirable characteristics the bioengineers are looking for. Maybe it's very lethal quickly. Maybe it incapacitates quickly. Anyway, they go to the animal kingdom, and they find what they want, and then they mix it. They do a little genetic engineering with pig genes. Why? Well, because these things don't jump the species barrier to man very easily. That's the beauty of the pig. The pig is the closest DNA in many respects, particularly when it comes to disease. It's arguably part of the reason why. Again, I don't like to say why Scripture says certain things, because we don't know. His mind is not ours. But certainly, it's easy to point to certain things and say, well, science at least confirms that when God says don't eat pig, he's telling us that for a reason. Anyway, it was one of those things that helped convince me years ago that the Scripture was correct and I'd been wrong. And it was a headline I saw in a science mag, and it said, science confirms pig DNA closest to human. This is why all those pandemics come through pork. Wow, I remember thinking. It's almost like, you know, the book of Leviticus had that nailed. Well, okay, where I was headed was, once upon a time, we could talk about plagues that were natural plagues that were visited on men by God because he was rebellious. But now, you know, man in the bio lab says, no, no, now we can produce better plagues, different plagues, plagues that have never been seen before, new plagues, kind of plagues that, well, we just happen to have the vaccine for, and if you're a good little boy or girl, maybe you'll even have some of that. Aren't we special? Aren't we nice? And besides which, of course, if we can sell it through Mr. Pharmacopoeia and our government-licensed preferred vendor of heavy-duty drugs, there's billions to be made. Especially if we get a good panic going first, right? Like Ebola or whatever the new one might be. I'm going to go back and read just a couple of verses that, as I'm talking about this aspect of plagues, plagues that can be engineered by man based on something that God created that man has said, ha, 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 we can be even more evil. We ought to consider it. So, if you've got a Bible, turn to Deuteronomy chapter 28. And it starts where I'm gonna go. Well, I'm gonna head to verse 60. So if you're making notes, put Deuteronomy 28, 60 down. But as far as reading it and getting it in context, let's start in verse 28 of here. What chapter 28 is talking about, by the way, is blessings and cursings. This is arguably one of the most important parts when people are wanting to come out of her, my people, and turn from the lies that we've inherited from our fathers, the whoppers we've been told by the Roman Catholic Church and all of its acolytes, the Methodists, Presbyterians, the Unitarians, and the, you know, fill in the blank, all the Ians out there that have their 501c3 and still keep Sun God Day and still say don't keep those Jewish feasts and all that kind of stuff. They're just variations on the Romanized pagan theme. Well, they will tell you this is not appropriate anymore, doesn't apply. And Scripture, of course, says just the opposite. Blessings for obedience, curses for rebellion, and the curses are pretty nasty. So with that as background, here we are in verse 57, and that's pretty ugly. So we'll go to 58, ha ha ha, and it just says this, if you will not observe to do all of the words of this Torah, I hate the word law in this context, it's bigger than law, folks, this is instruction. He's given us examples, he's given us statutes, judgments, and commandments, he's given us stories, he has made it really clear in every way he can, in genuine print, that, you know, it'll work out a whole lot better for you if you'll just obey what I tell you. And it's not just the commandments, the law, in other words. He has provided reasons, too, that you ought to want to do this. So, if you will not observe to do all the words of this Torah, this instruction that are written in this book, that you may fear this glorious and fearful name, Yahuwah Eloheka. See, they even take his name out in this context. Then Yahuwah will make your, listen to this, make your plagues wonderful, even the plagues of your seed, even great plagues and of long continuance, and sore sicknesses and of long continuance. Now that sounds pretty nasty, but we're just getting started. Verse 60 follows. And he will bring back upon you all of the diseases of Egypt, Mitzrayim, which you were in dread of, and they shall cleave to you. Remember boils and other things? Nasty diseases? All right, well, that sounds pretty bad. You keep doing this nasty stuff, and he's going to bring back those plagues of Egypt that once upon a time were visited on people who were in rebellion. Was there a separation made at that point? Yeah, actually there was. Interesting. But we're not done. Don Pardo, tell them what they've won. There's more. And also every sickness and every plague, which is not written in this book of the Torah. Them will Yahuwah bring upon you until you are destroyed. Now it's interesting here. Shema. That's the same word. Isn't that interesting? That's the same word that Pharaoh's advisors told him right here in the beginning of this Torah portion. It was first time it was used in Scripture. They're talking to Pharaoh, and they said, man, don't you get it? Egypt is destroyed. And they use that word. How funny is that? So here's the creator of the universe telling you, look, if you won't listen, I'm going to bring back all those plagues. And not only that, but more, every sickness, every plague, which is not even written in the Torah. Them will he bring upon you until you are destroyed. Now, when I look at that, when I read that in context, and I hope, at least, you know, as persuasively as I'm able to make the case, when I look at geoengineering and bioengineering and genetically modified frankenfoods and man-made bioweapons that can be engineered to kill specific races of people, you name it, hey folks, they got a specific gene, a designer bioweapon that'll kill it. And they can kill it in a whole bunch of different ways. Is it just possible that the Creator might say, all right, you know, in these plagues to come, we unleash some of that? I think it's probably about as obvious as the nose on your face. And I'm going to suggest the following, too, because as I put this together, one of my goals is to try and say, let's think about these plagues and put them in the buckets. First set, second set, third set, public, private, or just plain punishment. Which ones are they? And this one looks to me like one of the plagues, literally, pun intended, that would go into the third set. And I also can't help but believe it's probably a plague that goes into the set that would be one of separation. Matter of fact, you know, as I'm thinking about it, I was going to put it in the second set. But you can make a pretty good case for the plague of darkness being like a bioengineered weapon that's unleashed against the whole earth and kills just about everything above ground. By this time, I expect all the Pharaoh's minions will be in their little hidey holes, thinking they're safe down there. Maybe that's where the darkness hits. Turn off the lights underground? That'd be fun, wouldn't it? But above ground, I have a suspicion that what's going to happen is there'll be people who have come out and who've said, don't eat pig, don't eat things that he says are not food, do the things that he does tell you to do. Maybe put some of a particular mark, or don't put a mark. That's a possibility too, right? And the plague gets visited on those that are not his. And they're destroyed. All of these things are possibilities. But what I'm trying to do is not tell you what's going to happen. I don't claim to be a prophet. I can read the prophets. And like many of us, I can connect the dots, and I'll try to connect dots, and I think iron sharpens iron is a good thing. But the goal here is to just kind of put some parameters in place and say, how can we look at these plagues? How can we begin to think about what might happen in the future and where we are on the timeline, and how do the pieces fit together? All right, I'm going through the list of plagues here. Some other ones that looked to me more like the ending of the sets. Power grid failure. Whether it's via an EMP, and of course, Pharaoh's magicians could make their own EMP. And as a matter of fact, this could happen more than once too. I can picture a cyber attack that is, that people are lied to and told this is an EMP, and it'll kill most of the people in the cities within, probably 72 hours. And then later on, we get a real cyber attack where China or Russia or the creator himself lights off a nuke. A nuke that would be at high altitude would bring down the power grids in whatever place it was shining upon. If the creator did it with a massive solar flare, it could take out the entire, you know, half of the earth that's facing the sun. And it's going to be a really big deal. So all of those are possibilities. Finally, there's one that I haven't at least addressed in this set, but I think it's obvious, and it, to my mind, looks like one of the first ones. Pharaoh's magicians can certainly do this. And the laws of the Creator still apply too, and that is economic meltdown. The plague of a complete collapse of the almighty fiat dollar and so forth. So all of that is definitely something that could happen. I do have one more thing. I did say this in the Come Out of Her My People show, so you'll hear it again, but I think it's important to point this out as well here too. When it comes to prophetic understandings, and I know there's a whole lot of pieces, it's not just the plagues, obviously, that, if you want to put it in a little bit of quotes, that we have to look forward to. Quote unquote, ha ha. But the next economic collapse, I have never believed, is the final one. It's not the Great Tribulation economic collapse or anything like that. I genuinely believe that the powers that be have planned, knowing full well that what's been going on can't continue, and that the Fed literally will pull the plug. And they'll do that at a time when they stand to make trillions of dollars by bringing the system down. And the replacement currency that'll almost certainly include some kind of a, well, let's just call it a mark, for lack of a better term, a permission that will be required to buy or sell. Maybe it'll be web-based. Maybe it'll be web 2.0 based and more secure, so that only the right people with the right connections to Pharaoh can participate, can buy or sell. And how better to practice, of course, than with the one piece of property that was explicitly protected by the Constitution. Ha ha! If you can do it to guns, right, you can do it to food for sure. So the next one, in other words, this next economic collapse, the one that we may have seen start yesterday, is probably not the big one. It's the sucker punch, the distraction that precedes the big one, which will follow. And it might be that at some point, again, the big one is really pulled by the Creator himself as well. Okay, let's do this. Let's talk about some of the things that are in the news that will at least also kind of help to outline this concept of the plagues. And I'll mention several of them here. One, we have a number of things going on in the world on the economic scene. Let's start there. This last week, the manipulated gold market, in spite of the manipulation, is not at as low as it's been. Whereas oil, however, price of a barrel of oil has dropped below $30 a barrel, to the point where the ratio, and this is something that the good economists will follow and point out as an indicator, the ratio of the price of gold to the price of oil. Another way to ask it is, well, how much does it cost, or how many barrels of oil can you buy? I'll put it that way. How many barrels of oil can you buy for an ounce of gold? Answer: almost 37. You can buy 36 barrels and change of oil for 1 ounce of gold. And of course, if it's a real ounce of gold as opposed to the paper ounce of gold, you probably get a lot more than that. So that's part A. Part B, of course, is whether you're talking about China or the meltdown in Europe, Eurozone, or Wall Street with the Dow Jones and the Standard & Poor's 500, or any of a bunch of other companies, countries. Maybe I repeat myself. Japan, Canada, etc. This last 2 weeks have been the worst beginning to a new so-called year ever. Worst ever in China, worst ever in Europe, worst ever in Wall Street. The worst beginning of a year, period. The Dow was down almost 400 points, 391 points on Friday, after getting literally hammered day after day after day after day. But not nearly as big as one that would get to the front pages, but the cumulative effect, right? Death by a thousand cuts, or death by a thousand slashes is probably the way to put it in this sense. And that brings me to this headline. This I actually just saw this morning when I took a quick peek, trying to see whether the web was working. It comes from Zero Hedge, one of my favorite economic sources. They will tell you stuff, and they will accumulate stuff from major sources, but it's just the kind of stuff that doesn't get on page one. All right. There are Federal Reserve branches, as most of you know, all across the country. The New York Fed, it's called the Empire Fed, released some pretty nasty data the other day. Basically, the Federal Reserve and their projections are saying, things aren't nearly as good as we lied to you about at the last Open Market Committee meeting. And here's the funny news from Friday. The Fed was supposed to release, the Atlanta Fed was supposed to release their GDP estimates. Looking forward, telling you what is going to happen, our prognostication for the year ahead. And they, in fact, revealed the most dire GDP estimate yet, 0.6%. They claimed it's positive, but not by much. And, of course, in order to do that, they lie about inflation. So, really, the economy is probably contracting. But they're admitting that it ain't going to grow very much. Now, this is the same Fed, at least in toto, that just finished saying things are so good, we can raise interest rates. Now, yeah, if you buy that, I got some, you know, Brooklyn Bridges to sell you and a whole bunch of paper gold. This matched the 0.6% recorded during the harsh winter first quarter. And they said this, one could be forgiven for thinking that there was some chicanery going on here. Because here's the part I haven't mentioned yet. The Fed, the Atlanta Fed, defied their own timetable, and they waited until after the markets closed, till after the carnage was done on Friday. Here you go. The markets literally are panicking. And the Atlanta Fed was supposed to release their GDP predictions. Had they come out and said, in spite of the fact that the market is panicking, we're going to tell you one other thing that's even worse. It ain't going to get any better. What would have happened? We'd probably been down 800 or 1,000 points instead of only 400. So what did the Fed do? Well, they delayed, they waited until after the markets closed, and then they lied about it. One could be forgiven, says Tyler Durden and Zero Hedge, for thinking that during today's already chaotic sell-off, the last thing the traders and the computer algorithms needed was news that economic growth in the U.S. had ground to a virtual halt in the quarter in which Janet Yellen decided what we need is an interest rate hike. It's funny if you look back at it. Moments ago, this was written on Friday afternoon, the Fed was kind enough to explain the reason behind this surprising delay for a report that it always, when it can, tries to release before noon. The answer? Technical problems. They had technical delays. Hey, maybe they were getting their internet service mucked with like we are. Big Brother's fixing to bring it down. Well, why not just muck with the Fed, too? Anyway, technical delays. And they went on to say, because Zero Hedge actually publicly questioned them, wrote a public tweet to the Federal Reserve chairman in Atlanta. And the answer was, no, there's nothing nefarious going on here. You can trust us. Yeah, sure. All right. Now, I'm going to come back to that, but I'm going to just mention one other thing. I'm going to do this out of order from what I had planned. Earlier this week, we had one of the biggest liars in the known universe sitting in the Oval Office telling people more whoppers. This is the guy with the imperial pen. And he starts out, of course, by saying that we are committed to the rule of law. Yeah, we have a high commitment to the rule of law. And see this pen? Right here. I'm holding it in my hand. That's the rule of law. Whatever I say it is, nothing more, nothing less. You can take your Bill of Rights. You can shove it in the toilet. And they already have. Remember, George Bush, and I'm quoting, called it a goddamn piece of paper, referring to the Constitution, famously, several years ago. It's gotten worse. Let's just put it that way. But this is the line I was getting to, because we had the Atlanta Fed waiting until after the market closed in order to release bad news that would have otherwise caused even more panic in a market that's already collapsing. Quote, this is the imperial pen wielder Obama's the first. Quote, anyone claiming that America's economy is in decline is peddling fiction. Unquote. Or maybe they're just waiting until after the market's closed. And I'm going to do a couple of other stories. This is going to sound a little bit more conspiratorial than usual, but I guess when we're talking about plagues and the kind of things that could be God, or it could be man trying to imitate God, or it could be God allowing man to do the kind of things man is already planning on doing up until he, the creator, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, decides to separate his people from the evils that are being done to those people who are walking in rebellion to him, which is kind of, again, where I tend to think we are. This comes from Dave Hodges. Now, some of you know Dave. He's the he does something called the Common Sense Show. He's a pretty prolific writer on the web. Part of a group of folks, and I don't know Dave personally. I know a lot of folks that Dave knows personally. Randy Yarborough, who does a show on my old network, American Freedom Network, is a good friend. Paul Martin does a the website that I use as one of the best aggregators out there, Revolution Radio. Paul and Randy are both here in Colorado, not too far away. And Hodges names them and a bunch of others. Paul Martin is a former Marine, so he's got some connections. Steve Quayle, who I'm sure a lot of you know. Steve, many years ago, essentially got one of his original starts on the same network that I started and that Randy started and that Paul started on, and a number of us, the American Freedom Network. In those days, it was called the American Patriot Network, and they were literally coerced into changing the name, I guess, during those kind of dark days. Anyway, Hodges first mentions a lot of folks, and he says, basically, I'm going to only trust certain people anymore because things have gotten ugly unless I know their backgrounds. And he names the Hagmans, Doug and Joe, Steve Quayle, a couple of others, including John Moore. John Moore's from Missouri, and I know John, but I've never met him face-to-face. Paul Martin and Randy Yarborough and a few others. So in other words, he is naming some of the same folks that I know personally to be good folks. And said the following, you know, I trust no one. Things are getting really ugly. And essentially, you got to verify everything anymore. In a lot of cases, of course, it's hard to verify things. Now, one of the things that I've been doing as long as I've been on the radio, and I do it especially with Torah, you'll hear me talk about markology, right? If I'm going to tell you, here is what the word says, and usually, if there's any doubt, we'll try to go back to the Hebrew on that score. Because in some cases, you know, the translations can lose a little something. But in any case, I'll try to make that as clear as I can. And when I'm connecting dots and saying this is what I think, sometimes, not always, but a lot of times I'll use the term markology. Right? This is my take on things. Your mileage may vary. You don't have to agree. You know, we can and will disagree on certain things. You don't have to see it the same way. But the point is, I'll try to distinguish when I'm telling you something I know from Scripture and from when I'm telling you something that I think is clear, but you might not. And furthermore, same thing goes when it comes to news, right? There are news sources. I like to see a couple, two or three sources on things, because that's another admonition from Torah. And yet, there are a number of places where you'll see something or hear something, and I'll say, you know, I quite frankly don't believe that. Or, and that's typically if it's the New York Times or maybe it's Russia Today, but I repeat myself, or the Washington Compost, or the Huffington Post, or Bloomberg, for crying out loud. Number of sources, in other words, that aren't nearly as reliable as others. And when I hear something from somebody like a Dave Hodges, who has some pretty decent insider sources, or a Paul Martin, I may or may not choose to report it as news because I can't necessarily verify it with a second source, but at least in terms of my own internal thought process, I'll think, well, that's probably pretty good info. Not that somebody can't lie to them just like they could lie to me, right? So I hope all of this is clear. With that in mind, I'm going to read this headline from Hodges and give you a couple of his conclusions and just say, I think probably the guy knows whereof he speaks, but I can't prove this. But it's a another sign of the times in post-constitutional America. Why is the CIA taking over Burns, Oregon, is the headline, he says. Trust nobody, personally verify everything. And he says this up front. In an attempt to control the narrative, you've got the Communist News Network, he calls them CNN, and Faux News, that's spelled F-O-X or F-A-U-X, have been the only media organizations that have not either been physically taken down or neutralized through infiltration by covert government operatives, many of them from the CIA. In other words, and he talks about his personal experience, and I remember reading it during the week when it unfolded and listened to him try to interview Ammon Bundy. Ammon Bundy is one of the guys that's in that building up in Oregon in the Malheur National Forest. And he would be called one of the ringleaders by Big Brother's propaganda press. So he was interviewed by Dave Hodges, and basically the story goes something like this. They had to pay a severe price for trying to interview Ammon Bundy. As many of you already know, he says, both of the two satellites that carry my show, as well as the phone lines, and the listen by phone option, in other words, multiple separate channels, and all supportive operations of my satellite provider were all taken down 1 minute before the interview was scheduled to begin. And if that's not conspiracy enough for you, when it comes to hiding the real truth up there in Burns, Oregon, Ammon Bundy and his colleagues simultaneously had every form of their communications taken down, too, at the exact same time. One would have to be one hell of a coincidence believer in order to not make the connection here. Now, you know, when I look at things like that and I say, you know what, it's not like we haven't seen attacks before. And I've joked frequently about when I'll say certain things, you can count on the web going down. Hey, isn't it interesting this morning, as we're talking about plagues, that it's been down probably more than it's been up, at least in certain venues. So it says the next day, though, his network and Ammon Bundy used alternative communication methods. They were able to at least get beyond, or so they thought, the censors of the federal government. They produced an interview, and I listened to it. It was a pretty good interview. And he says that what he unearthed and that Ammon Bundy was able to tell him has been so far the only honest explanation of what they're really trying to accomplish up there. And it has to do with restoring property rights for ranchers and for Native Americans in the West. Now, Hodges has gone on to make a number of other points about this. I'm going to mention this. I mentioned the story last night about the fact that there is a fire marshal in Burns, Oregon. A fire chief, I guess, is the term. Harney County fire chief, got a fellow named Chris Bryles. And he resigned, said a story that I did, yesterday and the day before, after discovering that there were undercover FBI agents posing as militia members in the vicinity. These are false flag, agent provocateurs, people pretending to be militia when in fact they're feds raising hell and trying to blame it on somebody else. They were harassing the locals. And basically what happened is the fire chief and a couple of the local officers got sick and tired of it, and they confronted these folks. And they were told, oh, no, we're feds. It's okay. See, we can do this. And then the story goes, the Harney County fire marshal went to a local judge who told him, shut up, don't say anything more about this, and maybe threaten him. That was the story as far as we knew it yesterday. Well, turns out there might even be more to it. And here's what Hodges says he has learned firsthand. Yes, it's true. Chris Bryles did resign his position. He resigned. He said, I'm not going to take it anymore. After discovering undercover, listen carefully, not CIA, not FBI agents, but CIA agents. Wait a minute, aren't they not supposed to operate in the United States? Isn't that a violation of their charter? And who cares, but the Constitution too? Anyway, no, it wasn't FBI agents, it was CIA agents that were posing as militia members near the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge. According to Bryles, he found CIA agents impersonating militia members who were harassing locals and lurking around the town's armory. Bryles then went to County Judge Steve Grasty, who told him to shut up, keep his distance, and furthermore, here are the other interesting factoids. For one, everybody already knew the FBI was in the area. They'd already established a presence. And then it comes out that another interviewer, Sheila Zielinski, whom some of you may know as well, she kind of hangs with the same crowd, interviewed Bryles. And he admitted that the judge, Grasty and Browse, were discussing the CIA, which also matches an independent source that Dave Hodges says he has. Briles was expelled from the meeting, and when Sheila Zelinsky interviewed Briles, he identified the infiltrators multiple times as CIA and continued to do so up until she pointed out, you do know this is an interview on the record, right? Whereupon he said, no, did I say CIA? I meant FBI! He then told Sheila that his life was in danger. And that was essentially what he'd been told already. So this is the kind of thing that we're dealing with, in other words. The lies and the depth of the lies just keeps getting worse and worse. I guess when I think about it in terms of plagues, I go back to this idea of the public versus the private. And you kind of got to wonder about it. So here's how Hodges summarizes, and I'm going to go from here to another point. It's known and expected, he says, that the FBI would be on the scene in Oregon in order to bring about an end, one way or the other, to this continuing drama. And we know how the end happened in Waco. The CIA brought in the so-called hostage rescue team, as well as Delta Force, and one of the most infamous murderers and snipers. Let's see, I'm drawing a blank here. Ruby Ridge, Idaho. Randy Weaver, his wife Vicky Weaver, and their son that was killed by Marshall Deaver, if I'm remembering right, Sammy Weaver, along with a dog. Lon Horiuchi, that was the name of the FBI sniper that shot Vicky Weaver through the neck holding their infant daughter. He's now in the Witness Protection Program, your tax dollars at work, after committing those murders in Waco. Anyway, Lon Horiuchi executed Randy Weaver's wife, Vicky, at their cabin there. And on the success of that, he went right to Waco, where he was out back with Delta Force, out of view of the cameras. And if you haven't heard this story, folks, look into the excellent movie made by a friend of mine, sadly, the late Mike McNulty. Waco, The Rules of Engagement was the name of Mike McNulty's film. That's what I was struggling with as well. There ended up being several in the series, as a matter of fact. Waco, A New Revelation came out with a bunch of new information about the cover-up. And finally, they did a series about the FLIR images, the infrared images, and debunked the Attorney General under a Republican administration, no less, Jack Danforth, who was lying about that as well. The whole thing is one sick story from beginning to never end. It was the first movie that laid the groundwork, the second one where Mike came up with the fact that it was, in fact, Delta Force that was out back and committed all of these literal crimes against the American people. And essentially what Mike pointed out is that, Delta Force was out back. Anybody that escaped out the back of the burning inferno was executed and their bodies were bulldozed back into the building, whereupon the trash, including all of the forensic evidence, was hauled off site and it was buried and it was contaminated and the chain of evidence was broken so that it would not be uncovered and the American people wouldn't know exactly what kind of a massacre of people in a church had happened in full view of the deluded American public. And now we've got something similar. So it's the FBI, and as I've said for a while, when they bring in the hostage rescue team up there, watch out. Here's the story that I'm not going to do in detail. I'm just going to mention a couple of comments from. This comes from Doug Casey. Some of you know Doug Casey. Now, where I part with Doug is a good libertarian, but not a Bible believer. He writes for the International Man. A number of the sources that I read all the time will relay his articles, including the 5-Minute Forecast and the Agora Financial folks and LouRockwell.com and even Tyler Durden and Zero Hedge in this case. So this one is up there all over the place. It's called The Ascendance of Sociopaths in U.S. Governance. Now, bear this in mind. This is almost funny, but it's really kind of sick funny. The kind of people who shouldn't have guns, according to the imperial pen wielder in chief in the United States, are the kind of people who believe in conspiracy theories and think that there's a God who wrote a Bible for us, and that more to the point, at least so far as he's concerned, there's actually a supreme law of the land, and it includes the Bill of Rights. Those are the people who, by definition, so far as they're concerned, and by the way, the Soviets and Mao Zedong perfected this technique, are mentally deficient. So therefore, they don't deserve to keep and bear arms. Got the story here. I'll mention out of sequence about what's it called? Orthorexia nervosa. It's a new disease that certain sycophants have identified. Orthorexia nervosa sounds kind of like anorexia nervosa, right? That's where women won't eat, primarily women. I guess there's probably a few anorexia guys out there too, but the vast majority are women. And they won't eat food, and they literally turn into skin and bones. Well, orthorexia nervosa is a new disease that, of course, is perfectly good grounds for denying you the right to keep and bear arms, so far as Big Brother is concerned. Orthorexia nervosa, these are people that actually care that their food is healthful. They read the labels. Now, they're not going to be allowed to read the labels for too much longer because Big Brother wants to get them gone, so that Monsanto, Inc., can basically put any kind of crap they want, call it food, and you won't even know that it's in there. From genetically modified sugar beets and canola to corn and soybeans and you name it. So if you're no GMO girl, for example, well, by definition, you probably have orthorexia nervosa. No guns for you. Back to this piece by Doug Casey. He says, the ascendance of sociopaths in U.S. governance is what really ought to be the thing that concerns us. Now, what's a sociopath? You're looking for a real mental disorder, arguably. Hitler had it. Pol Pot had it. Idi Amin had it. Others have had it. And certainly, whatever the guy's name in the White House, you know, the first imperial dictator in the United States that has multiple aliases, has it too. Sociopathy. Arguably, Bill Clinton had it, too. Better put some ice on that. All right. This is how, after some introduction that I'm going to skip over, Casey puts it. He says, look, we live in a society that's confronted by economic depression, looming financial chaos, serious currency inflation, onerous taxation, crippling regulation, a developing police state, and worst of all, probably a major war. Seems almost unbelievable these things could affect the United States, which historically, right, it could never happen here. It's been the land of the free. How'd we get here? Well, he says something I've been saying for a long, long time. Never ascribe to conspiracy that which can be explained by stupidity. All right, that's true. But then you go back and read what Franklin Delano Roosevelt, another truly evil U.S. president and a fascist, because he believed in the public-private partnership and overturned the system of governance that we once had. He stole the American people's gold, too. He said, in politics, nothing happens by coincidence. If something happens, you can bet it was planned that way. Probably one of the few things he ever said that was really true. The only thing we have to fear is government in itself. No, that's not quite what he said. Anyway, Casey puts it this way. When things go wrong on a massive, on a grand scale, it's not just bad luck or stupidity or inadvertence. It's because of, and he puts it this way, character flaws on the part of one or many or even all of the players involved. Character flaws. Well, folks, I'll go a step further. Again, this is where I part company with Casey. I'm going to go through some of his comments because they're good and just point out to you, know that it goes deeper. We see it with Pharaoh. We see it with this Torah portion. It's not just a character flaw. It's not just hubris, in other words, in Pharaoh. Pharaoh thought he was a god. Hey, does that sound familiar? You ever heard the term Obamasiah? But it's not just limited to Pharaoh or to King Ahab many, many years later, or to Adolf Hitler, or Joseph Stalin, or any number of high-profile characters you could name. It goes a bit deeper. We're talking about people who have a confirmed, undeniable, unmistakable animosity. Who is this Yahuwah? I know him not! Famous words from Pharaoh. Famous last words. That's the kind of animosity that I suggest we're talking about here, and a nation which has forgotten him. Back to Doug, who says, in this article, I'm going to argue that the U.S. government in particular has been overrun by the wrong kind of person. Now, he sees it. He sees it all up until the point where he fails to recognize that these are people who deny the Creator himself. It's a trend, says Casey, that's been in motion for many years. Now, however, it's reached the point of no return. Moral rot has become so prevalent that it's now institutional in nature. So there won't be any serious change in direction in which the U.S. is headed until a genuine crisis topples the existing order. Till then, it's going to accelerate. No, I'm going to disagree. A genuine crisis is going to topple the existing order. They've already got that prepared. They're going to strengthen the existing order when the crisis that they have created and pulled the pin on the hand grenade develops. Let's be real here. There won't be any serious change until the great regathering, until the creator of the universe comes out and says, all right, third set of plagues, I'm taking off the gloves, I'm separating my people from theirs, and I'm going to make it darned clear, I'll say it, damned clear, that those who will not listen will be damned, will be cursed, will be destroyed, and that it is Ani Yahuwah, that is the Creator and the Creator alone, who is doing what is going on. And that's the key. I think that's part of the reason why I do stories like this one, because there's a lot of folks that would generally be on the right track that aren't willing to admit that the real issue here is, in fact, a spiritual one. And it's not just, oh, I'm a spiritual person, but I don't believe in God. It's not BS like that. It's the fact that there truly is a God. Hey, the Egyptians believed in gods, for crying out loud. Everybody in Washington believes in God. They see one every time they look in the mirror, or turn on their TV, or watch the State of the Union. It's just not the right God. Back to Doug Casey. The reason, he says here, is that there's a certain class of people. Sociopaths. Now here I think he's right. He just, again, doesn't go far enough. Sociopaths are now fully in control of the major American institution. And these beliefs and attitudes of the sociopaths are literally insinuated throughout the economic, political, intellectual, and psychological. And here he puts this word as a slash, spiritual fabric of the U.S. That's as close as he gets to really admitting the bottom line in this situation. Well, what does this mean to you as an individual? Well, it all depends on your character. Do you support your country, right or wrong, like the Germans did in the 1930s? Are you one who dodges the duty to be a helpmate to murderers? In other words, you can do the right thing regardless of the consequences. Are you going to tell the truth? Right? You've got a guy here, sounds like a good guy, up in Harney County, the fire chief, who is coming out and admitting it and has resigned his job, says, I'm not going to take this paycheck from these scumbags anymore. But he's scared. And I guess most of it say, well, we understand why he's scared. He's run up against some people who do wet work, as they call it. And they don't hesitate to kill, because they're serving another master. Now, I know a lot of them are probably listening. Some of them will be saying, oh, no, no, we serve a God. We took an oath. Well, bullshit. Pardon my bluntness. If you serve God, then you serve Him. But don't tell me you're killing people and doing evil in the name of a God that says, no, no, you're not. You don't break His word, His instruction, or the oath that you took, and then tell me you're serving Him. You're a liar and the truth is not in you. You can go pick up the book and read those words for yourself. Back to Casey. He says, what the ascendancy of sociopaths means is not an academic question. It really is a matter of life or death. He goes back and he talks about some history. I'm not going to do that because we could do it and have done it many, many times. You might be thinking, he says, that you go look at history. You see places like Nazi Germany, Soviet Russia, Mao's China, Pol Pot's Cambodia, scores of other countries in recent history, and you say, well, that couldn't possibly happen here. Actually, he says, and I'm trying to make the same point, there's no reason it won't. All the institutions that once made America exceptional. Now, listen to this list, folks. And here's where I wish Doug would just come and realize the truth too. So, you know, Doug, may you be blessed and may the God of the Bible chasten you till you realize He is real. But I'm going to read the line. Quote, all the institutions that made America exceptional, including a belief in capitalism, individualism, self-reliance, and the restraints of the Constitution, are now only historical artifacts. Wait a minute. Is there something missing from that list? Let me see if I can't remember a line that once upon a time meant something. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal and that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights. And he left the most important single line in all of American history, originally written in English, off the list. You're looking for the thing that made America exceptional once upon a time? It's a belief that we have rights that come from God, the creator of the universe, and that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. What powers can be delegated to a government? Answer, the ones that are delegated by the people. Where did they get what they got? From their creator. And by the way, he holds them to certain standards. At least 10 of them that are obvious. And when we forget that, we run right afoul of exactly what Casey is trying to write about here, but he's handicapped because he's not going to tell the whole truth. Because the real truth is, when a nation forgets God, this stuff is not only going to happen, it's inevitable. And when it forgets him to the place that it is today, the plagues are already prepped and waiting. He does say this. Again, he gets, well, the 80-20 rule. He's even going to talk about the 80-20 rule in this piece. He says, on the other hand, the distribution of sociopaths is pretty uniform across space and time. Per capita, there's probably no more evil people in Stalin's Russia, Hitler's Germany, Mao's China, Uganda, Ceausescu's Romania, or Pol Pot's Cambodia than there are today in the U.S. But what you need is favorable conditions for them to bloom. Kind of like mushrooms do after a rainstorm. Conditions for the U.S. have become quite favorable to them. Hey, take a look. Have you ever wondered where the 50,000, I'm going to say it, he doesn't put it this way, the 50,000 scumbags employed by the TSA to inspect and degrade you and teach you how to be a good little slave came from? Most of them are middle-aged. Did they have jobs before they started doing something any normal person would consider demeaning, even reprehensible, even rape? Well, most did. But somehow they were attracted to, rather than repelled by, a job where they could wear a costume and abuse their fellow citizens all day and be superior. Now, I know, and a lot of you are saying, oh, I've talked to some of these folks. They say, I'm sorry about having to grope your gonads, feel your breasts, do all this stuff that once upon a time, well, if I actually took an oath, I would know was a violation of the supreme law of the land. I've had this discussion with people for years. Back when I first started doing radio with the Denver Police Department, I called them the Car Thieves in Blue. Denver cops take an oath, just like all other police in Colorado and indeed every other place that I know of do, to defend the Constitution of the United States and of the state of Colorado. And in Denver, they were violating the explicit strictures of the Colorado Constitution. The Colorado Constitution and the laws basically say you can have a gun. You can have it in your glove box. In Denver, there was a so-called nuisance law that they would steal the gun and your car. Hence, I call them the Car Thieves in Blue. And the question I got asked, and I answered pretty bluntly, was, do you think somebody with integrity can be a Denver cop? Answer, hell no. What kind of person can take an oath to a constitution that they then proceed to, is there a polite word to say crap upon? Disregard? Violate their oath before God? Do I have any respect for that kind of a person? The answer is hell no. They're a liar and the truth is not in them. They're an oath breaker. They're a thief. They're committing crimes under what would have been called, back when we had a rule of law, color of law. You got a gun and a badge, you put a uniform on, and you do not act like a law enforcement officer, much less somebody who is supposed to protect and serve. You're a criminal, sir. And you're a liar. And why the hell would I respect you for that? And I had people tell me, well, Mark, maybe there are some good cops in the Denver PD that are undercover, you know, infiltrating the agency so that when they're then told later to go break down people's doors and kill them, maybe they won't. Well, gee, thanks. And I've referred to this in many, many times past. Point is, folks, we ought to be in a place where we can say, look, you know what? A Nazi that says, I believe in God, but I'm going to go ahead and put these Jews in that, that nice Auschwitz prison camp there because they'll be safer there. And besides which, guy's got to put food on the table. Don't want to be called an infidel, do I? Well, excuse me. This goes to you people in the NSA headquarters that are listening. And all of you three-letter agencies out there, whether it's BATF, which, if we had a constitution, would not exist, or the FBI's hostage rescue team, or any of other scumbags that are listening and saying, oh, we're just doing good things to protect the national security of the bull. You are liars, and the truth is not in you. You stand before God, you put your hand on a Bible. Well, nowadays, some of you at TSA don't. But those of you that did, take an oath before God to defend a constitution that you've never read. Oh, well, we've read it. Well, then, why does shall not be infringed not apply? Well, these are people who have made an agreement with Satan, and so therefore we're enforcing Satan's rules upon them. Well, at least come out and admit it. In other words, folks, there is a grain of truth that's pretty big in Casey's article here. We have a lot of sociopaths that can justify anything. What's important? What I want. The essence of a sociopath, in other words, is to be able to look you square in the eye and lie and imitate normal reactions, but not be moved at all by the death or the theft or the rape or the murder. I repeated myself, but hey, all of these things boil down to the same thing. In other words, to break the law with impunity because I'm above the law. You want to run for president? Hillary Clinton's the best example I can think of. She committed treason, was involved in the execution of the Libyan ambassador, as well as some service people, covered it up. They have fired any number of flag rank officers to cover it up. She committed massive acts of felonies and violation of national security by literally taking the labels off of confidential documents, storing them on an unsecured server, sending them to avowed enemies of the United States, all in the furtherance of, well, stuff that still isn't even coming out. And what has she done? She's proven that she is perfect to infect the Oval Office. Can you find a better example of a sociopath? And she's married to one, too.
All depends on what the meaning of the word is. Yes.
These are the kind of people who rise to the top, like scum does in a pus-infected wound. Conditions, as Casey says, for these kind of sociopaths are quite favorable in the U.S. People are attracted to these jobs because they can abuse their fellow citizens all day. You really want to be the power monger, de tutte power mongers? De capo, de tutte capo? You want to run for president. If you've never met these kind of folks, and I've talked to governors and senators and was involved in politics for a long time, there's a certain kind of hubris there. There are very, very rare exceptions. I got to know Ron Paul. A very, very rare exception to those kind of people who basically want to rule, and they know better than you how to run your life. Few of these people, says Casey, can imagine that they're really shepherding in a police state as they play their roles in the security theater. He's talking particularly about TSA. But if you step back and ask yourself the question, these are exactly the same kind of people who joined the Gestapo. They were eager to control everyone else. And by the way, he notes, the Gestapo was not a draft organization. People went into it because they wanted to go there. Anybody remember Ephraim Zimbalist Jr., the FBI years ago? What an organization of integrity. They wore suits. They went to the best colleges. The ATF were where the revenuers went. These were the people that couldn't make the FBI, couldn't pass the cut. Well, we look at the situation today. Now, I know there are FBI agents listening or will listen at some point. I'm going to ask you, does any of that still apply? I don't think it did then, honestly. Knowing what we know about J. Edgar Hoover and so forth, these things were always full of rot. The reason why the FBI was limited originally to interstate kind of things was because it's explicitly prohibited by the Constitution from doing the kind of stuff that it does now. Same thing goes for the CIA. Matter of fact, fill in three letters, especially if it starts with a B or ends with an A, and it's probably an unconstitutional executive branch agency that would not exist if we had a constitution. I know this is, again, let me take it back and say we are talking today about the plagues. And I'm talking about the public and private aspects of the plagues. I think that's an interesting combination too, right? How is it that the plagues are being visited on Americans today? What is the essence of fascism as an economic system? It is a public-private partnership. It's where the blurring of the lines gets to be so indistinct that you can't tell whether an entity is public or private. I've told the story about going to the Rockies baseball games years ago and being told, Achtung, you will let us inspect your bag? You have a baseball glove in there. What are you doing with a baseball glove? Literally, and that's where we took our season tickets and told them, put them where the sun don't shine. The day I can't bring a baseball glove to a ballpark is the day I'm going to tell you I'm not going to be a season ticket holder anymore. And I had run-ins week after week, year after year, with the people that were trying to do inspections at the gates. And for a long, long time, I refused. They'd say, may I look in your bag, sir? No, you may not. And I'd walk through. Year after year. May I look in your bag? Nope, you may not. Thank you. And I walked on through. And well, then eventually they stopped me. And one day they sent the cops. And the cops physically, two of them, picked me up and started to haul me out the gate. And I said, I'm a season ticket holder. And the woman said, and by the way, this was after a supervisor had already been called. And as she was throwing me out the gate, I said, ma'am, I think before you commit a crime, you'd better ask a couple of questions. And she says, well, put him down. What questions? And I'd say, well, let me just start by asking you a question. Is this a public venue? Well, yes, I've already explained that to you, sir. It says on your tickets that when you agree to this, that's a condition of entry. Because, you know, we're a private organization here. This is a private organization, the Rockies baseball team. It's a private venue. That's how come we can search your bags, because as a condition of entry, you agree to that. I said, well, let me ask you a question, then a follow-up. If this is a private venue, what are these Denver City public paid goons doing here? And furthermore, why are you getting tax dollars to subsidize your stadium? She hyperventilated for a second and then turned to the guys and sent them away and said, go on in. Go on in. And the week following, they changed the rules and published new signs at the entry to the park. The point is, it was a public-private partnership. It's the essence of fascism. And you see, the whole point of fascism is, if it's public, well, then the Constitution applies. You have certain rights to keep and bear arms, freedom of assembly, freedom of worship. You can speak. But if it's private, hey, if this is a private employer, we can tell you, you can't bring a gun in here. Or you can't have a symbol of your God. You're not allowed to wear a cross around your neck or some, a kippah or a tzitzit. Whatever we decide we want to do, we'll say that violates the dress code. It's private. You don't have those rights here. But if it's public-private partnership, now we can violate any rules we want. We're public when we want to be. We're private when we want to be. Hey, how do you like that? It's a insidiously effective system. So it's funny to me that the plagues that we talk about, the three sets of three, were essentially public and private. Plague number one, public. Plague number two, private, individual. And I kind of wonder, how's that going to play out in a completely fascist regime? I suspect the Creator is still going to be able to distinguish the public from the private, but it'll be fun to watch. All right, I want to make one or two more comments. Any questions? Did I miss any questions yet? We'll start to wrap things up, because this is key, and I'm going to talk about a couple of how we can do things, what we need to do as these plagues begin to play out before we finish it. Casey goes on to talk about how it is that 80% of people are basically decent. He too refers to Pareto's law, the 80-20 rule, tells us that 80% of your sales come from 20% of your salesmen. 20% of the population provide 80% of the crime. You want to mix lies with truth. 80-20 is a good ratio. 80% of the people in most societies are basically decent. They live by the golden rule. 20%, though, are what he calls potential trouble sources. They don't normally do the wrong thing, but if the opportunity presents itself, they don't necessarily wait or hesitate too long. They're perfectly benign in normal times. They play golf on the weekends. They pet the family dog. But given the choice and the necessity, they'll sign up for the Gestapo, the Stasi, the KGB, the TSA, Homeland Security, or the CIA. And they'll often see force as the solution to any problem. But that's not all. As he points out, among the 20%, you still got the 80-20 rule. 20% of the 20% are the really bad actors. These are the Hitleries, the Obamas, the people who rise to positions of power for the virtue and glory of power alone. They'll work their will on other people because they're enthusiastic about government. They rise to positions of leadership. They're willing to break the rules. I worked for a guy at IBM years ago. I won't name him. Interesting fellow. Sociopath. Literally. And you know what? To some extent, I liked working for him because he was a good manager. I'm looking around the room. Some of the people know who I'm talking about. And what I could say about this fellow was, you knew where you stood with him. If you were helping his career, he would do all the right stuff. You'd get promotions, you'd get the rewards that were specified in the book, and he would, in fact, go get you the resources you needed to do your job because it was in his interest. And the instant, and I mean the instant, that what you were doing wasn't in his interest anymore, you better be looking for another opportunity. And heaven forbid that you would cross the guy. This is the kind of people that are involved in so many of these positions. All right, and then Casey begins to conclude by talking about how it was kind of sad what George Bush did when he was in office. Because he was Bubus Americanus himself and made such a big deal out of evil, he said, as if it existed only in places like North Korea and Iraq and Iran, he discredited the concept of evil itself. He violated, he trivialized the concept of evil, and he made it seem downright banal because he was such a fool. Now this is, I thought, an interesting point. He says the truth is that the real evil that he was ignoring was running him. It was very immediate, very powerful, growing right around him, and he lacked the awareness to see that he was fertilizing it by turning the United States into exactly the kind of mushroom fostering state, a prison complex, a police state. After 9/11, the national security state. And now, says Casey, it's out of control. Well, again, it's out of control, but the solution is broader than Casey sees. I don't believe it can be fixed at this point. That's part of what I'm trying to say and part of why I'm talking about the plagues. I think the plagues are here. They're at the door. We've seen some of the parameters laid out for them. And we see some of the people that are going to be involved. I've mentioned a lot of the sociopaths. You go to Europe. We got the stories, I'm not going to do them again, about the rape fears from the Muslim invasion. Literally, all over Europe. Europe has been pre-disarmed. Women are afraid to go out at night, and rightfully so. The cops have been lying to them. Now they're finally coming out and admitting, oh, well, we've been lying about this for months. We've been covering up the incidents of rapes and crimes and all of these things that are being committed by the migrants. Why? Well, because we were told to, although they're not going to admit that. What happened in Sweden this week was that there was an investigation of police cover-ups of these massive crimes that was shut down, and the federal prosecutors in Sweden refused to investigate. Why? Because the orders came from them. At least that would seem to be the case, right? Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. And nowadays, these not just, you know, the things that happen in Cologne, they've been admitted in Sweden, Finland, Germany, Austria, Switzerland. There was a story this week about a gang rape. Bunch of migrants outside of one of these hostels where they're putting up the migrants, gang raped a 3-year-old boy. And that was covered up for a while too. But it's all beginning to leak out because it's gotten to the point where it can't be hidden. And in the United States, we're seeing attempts to literally foment World War III, hence what's going on up in Oregon and other places. They tried it in Ferguson, tried it in Baltimore, and they'll keep trying it until they manage to get somebody somewhere, even if they have to implant their own agents, be they called CIA or FBI, to do the false flag bombings or shootings or whatever themselves. And quite frankly, folks, I don't have any doubt if you go back and look at the false flag events that we saw in Boston and other places, with various government contractors. The term during the Nixon regime was plausible deniability. As you know, if you've ever seen any of the movies even about the CIA, the company generally likes to hire private contractors to do the wet work and the other important stuff. I want to talk about at least one of the first couple of plagues that I think are going to happen. I had several questions people always ask about, well, you know, on the come out of her scale, what kind of things can we do? One of them, of course, is come out of the money system. That is, in fact, the way most people get trapped into the system. It's how the mark will be implemented, I have no doubt. The licensing scheme that Barry Sotero is pushing, everybody's got to have an FFL, a federal firearms license, so that Big Brother can decide who is allowed to buy and sell. What is it? It's just another form of agreement that says, we've got you. You slave of the almighty state, you. And once you enter into the agreement, it's part of the reason, once you enter into the agreement, you're done. Pharaoh, right? He can harden his own heart for a while, but once eventually he's in for a penny, in for a pound, he's going to play the game to the conclusion. Same thing seems to be the case with Big Brother. Once I've got you, I'm going to keep you. Fortunately, we do have a redeemer who can bail us out of mistakes that we've made that are deserving of death. So don't forget that. There is always remedy in the law. That's a term that you'll see that once upon a time was taught in America. If there's no way out, it's not real law. Especially when it comes to a contract. Just make sure that you don't make the mistakes again. Having been reprieved, don't get back into the same scheme. So, knowing that what we need to do is to come out of her and be separate, as we move through or begin to recognize when these plagues are playing out, do the best we can to come out, avoid entangling alliances, other agreements, making the deal with the devil again after that. And silver is key in that. If I had more time, I'd talk about a great piece from Bill Holter called The Chinese Silver Fox. And basically, his thesis here, and it's pretty well done, is that he believes that China has been helping to prop up the crooked casinos, the paper silver in particular, and paper gold markets, by being willing to trade massive amounts of silver privately, covertly, for massive amounts of gold. Because silver would probably have been the market that would have broken first and revealed the whole big lie. So again, he makes a pretty good case. It's part of the reason why I just say, hey, understand silver is kesef in scripture, it's real money, and that as people want to come out and want to avoid participating with the evil, we're going to have to find some way of trading one another. And barter is fine, it works, but barter is difficult. Because odds are, if you've got a bunch of rutabagas and the next door neighbor doesn't want rutabagas, you're going to have to find something he wants, and he's going to have something you want. And that was the whole point of a medium of exchange, money, silver, cassette. Jim Willey talks about double-barreled, hidden, QE to infinity. And he, among many at this point, are simply saying, look, there's no lying, no denying that things are coming to a head, whether it's the stock market meltdown, a lagging indicator. It's really, really getting ugly out there. And when that arguably first plague of the money meltdown happens, a whole lot of people, and that would include believers that are not prepared, are going to suffer. They're going to suffer the public and then the private loss of property that's associated with these first few plagues. So be aware of it. Now, this one, too, I mentioned, and I'm going to spend the last minute or two just talking about yet another means of doing this. Understand that you want to control people, says one of the biggest evil brothers in the world, UN. You control food, you control water. You got them. People can live for a while without food. They can't last very long without water. When you see the war on the West and how it's playing out, water is a big element of this. Hodges, in parts of the story that I didn't mention, talks about how it's the Chinese, right? Same folks that have been propping up the scheme, the system, and being willing to allow a little leeway in the squeeze so they can accumulate more gold, are also accumulating, evidently, uranium from off of the Hammond Ranch and the Bundy Ranch and from places around those that, with the cooperation of the various three-letter agencies like BLM, they're stealing people's property. This has been done by design. The landlord is essentially being squeezed to sell out to those that are holding the paper. So all of this will eventually be revealed. Finally, this story, okay? And I mentioned this last night. Some of you have probably heard it by now. In Canada, Canada is in a world of hurt lately. Oil prices have affected them, mining prices, commodity prices. Their economy has a larger segment even of mining and related industries than the U.S. does. And the dollar has been, the Canadian dollar, the loonie, has been hammered. It's down 25% or more against the fake fiat U.S. dollar. Here are current prices for food in Canada now. There's grocery store stuff are up online. A box of Frosted Flakes, major U.S., major Canadian chains, you know, the equivalent of their, what would it be called? It's King Supers, City Markets, you know, the major chains anyway. Box of Kellogg's Frosted Flakes, $15.99. A box of Tide detergent, $31.99. A cucumber, if you're willing to buy two. Two for $6. $3 for a cucumber. A gallon of chocolate milk, $17.79. And a dozen eggs, $8.19. Now guess what, folks? I don't think that's organic stuff, for the most part. This is not the best foods, in other words, that you're going to get. This is the cheap stuff. You want real nutritious food, it's going to cost more or be unavailable. So Mike Adams published a piece earlier. It was just the article title is good enough. He says, 5 reasons why you're totally crazy if you're not growing your own food. And, of course, the bottom line is, if you want to be a slave of the almighty state, if you want to eat stuff that Big Brother says you ought to eat as opposed to the Creator, then play in that ballpark with his ball. Otherwise, food and medicine likely to be unobtainable real soon now. And that's the thing to remember. So I guess what I'm trying to say is there's never been a better time to understand that when the suggestion is made to come out of her, it's serious. And it's time. And that insofar as watching and knowing the times and the seasons is concerned, this is the point where we literally ought to be looking at the parameters of the plagues, studying the story of the Exodus, of Pharaoh, of the hubris, of the nature of these so-called gods, of Egypt, of Mitzrayim, and recognizing that Scripture still uses terms like Babylon and Egypt, hundreds, thousands of years after the fact, because they're still appropriate. And I refer to the Greater Babylon metro area only somewhat, tongue-in-cheek. I think we are in the Greater Babylon metro area. And if you want to call it Egypt, well, we've got American Pharaoh, too. Is there a difference? That's an interesting point. Ultimately, I'm not sure that it matters. They're both pagan places and conquerors trying to reduce people to slavery to another set of gods. And the response is the same. Come out of her. Be separate. And make sure we know that when he says, Ani Yahuwah, we need to know what that means. Teach our children. Keep his commandments, his statutes, his judgments. Walk in obedience to him. Know that it's his feast that we're talking about. And I saw it online last night. I think it's a good comment. It was important this year. It's going to be continually to be increasingly important in the years to come. Keep those things that he says, memorialize, if you prefer that term, his set apart times. Do whatever we can, in other words, to walk as best we can in obedience, because there are blessings for obedience, and it includes being separated and set apart. All right. Did I miss any questions? I guess what I'll do is I'll wait and I will I'll reconnect to Pal Talk and see if any questions will appear on the screen. Pal Talk is really irritating. There we go. Oh, that it told me it wasn't going to come up and then it came up anyway. So it lies and then it does right. How do you like that? Okay, so hopefully I will be back in the room in a second. All right, so I'm in the room, and by the time you all hear what I'm saying, I will already have been in the room for a little while. So if there's any questions, in other words, put them up. And other than that, we'll close as we always do with some prayer. Yahuwah Eloheinu, Yahuwah Echad, Abba. Things do seem to be getting serious. We're seeing what look like at least precursors to plagues on any number of fronts. We pray, Father, that you'd give us eyes to see and ears to hear. And help us to be in the place, whether it's a set-apart physical place or places or a spiritual place or whatever form it takes, Abba. Show us individually and in our communities, in our fellowships, in our families. Show us where we need to be and what we need to be doing. And we pray that we could be counted worthy to escape these things that are coming upon the earth, and that we would be found doing your work in the time of your return, and that most importantly, we would be good and faithful servants through whatever lies ahead. Help us to speak your truth boldly. We have loved ones, Abba, that we know are walking in rebellion. We have so-called leaders. We have people in positions of power, if not lawful authority, that are doing evil and saying that they're doing it for our good. Help us to know when to speak up and when to remain hidden under your wings. Guide us that the things we do, in other words, would be pleasing to you and in accord with your instruction. When we can be witnesses to others, let us do so boldly. And when we need to be elsewhere, help us to have that understanding. Father, we pray that you'd bring those to us that we need to have in community and in fellowship and in houses and families and in marriages in this time ahead, that we would be ready for whatever it is that's coming. Give us the material, the economic, the physical, the food, the other kinds of support and provision from you. Help us to know that those things do come from you and from you alone. Father, we simply pray that your will would be done and that we would be able to be called good and faithful servants. Bo Mashiach. We ask all of this in your name, in accord with your word. For you are Yahuwah Rapha, our healer, who heals us from these diseases, whether they're diseases we've seen in Mitzrayim or things that are yet to come. Yahuwah Vitzivenu, Yahuwah Zevuot, Yahuwah Nisi. We thank you and we praise you. Hallelujah. Amen. And let's close with the Aaronic blessing, as we always do as well, or try to remember to do at least on Shabbat. We remember that Yahuwah spoke to Moshe, saying, "Speak to Aharon and his sons and say to them, Yivarecha ka Yahuwah varishmarecha, Ya'er Yahuwah panavalecha vikunecha, Isa Yahuwah panavalecha v'yasim lecha ha ha. Shalom. May Yahuwah bless you and keep you. May Yahuwah make his face to shine upon you. May Yahuwah lift up his countenance upon you and give you his shalom. Amen.